Now it's time for our weekly film reviews, and we have three up for scrutiny today. Fuse, a British heist thriller starring Aaron Taylor-Johnson. DJ Amit, a coming-of-age drama set in rural Macedonia. And lastly, a documentary about Kim Novak and her iconic role in Hitchcock's Vertigo. Tara Brady and Declan Burke have been to the cinema for us. Good evening, Tara and Declan. It's lovely to have you in.
Okay.
Now, let's begin with Fuse. I keep on wanting to say Fuzz, by the way, when I read it. But anyway, it stars Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who plays Major Tranter, who heads up an army bomb disposal squad, who were called in to deactivate an unexploded World War II bomb in central London. And meanwhile, a gang sees the opportunity to undertake a massive bank heist. It seems like it could be a bit of fun. Tara, what is this movie about?
Well, it is just as you say, it's very much kind of a game of two halves, because in the first part you have this, which is one of the great cinematic tropes of all time, a ticking bomb, or possibly ticking bomb. We know that that's something that Hitchcock has talked about, and we also know that in the hands of a great director like say Catherine Bigelow, she can get some really nail-biting action out of an unexploded device in something like The Hurt Locker. And the first part I actually really enjoyed, because it has all this procedural stuff going on that's really interesting and quite thrilling, because it's like, well, what happens when they do come across an unexploded presumably World War II bomb in London? How do they evacuate? Who do they call in? And you have Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character, and she's this unflappable chief superintendent, and she's liaising with the bomb disposal people, who are headed up by Aaron Taylor-Johnson. So all that stuff is fine. When the film seegs into the heist, it for me just becomes a lot of running around, and it's a lot less sort of clear and interesting. And there's no reason for that to be, because, you know, Dave McKenzie's he's a good director, he's a solid director, but to me the heist part with Sam Worthington and Theo James just doesn't really take off in the same way as the bomb part.
Declan, as Tara was saying there, it is a heist film. Does it stay close to the genre?
Yes, it's kind of tries to be the heist movie to end all heist movies, because some heist movies, they're all about the setup and the logistics and the planning and so forth, and some of them get the heist out of the way, and, you know, the inevitable consequences when things go awry and everybody descends into chaos and so forth. This tries to blend all the aspects of all the kind of great heist movies. I liked it better than Tara did. I think there's three parallel narratives, as she says, and I think they're well linked together. What I liked best about it, I think, was that the main characters are very sharply drawn, because you can get these really fast-paced thrillers and it's all about the twists and the turns and so forth, but there's some really good characters. Tranter, the Major Tranter character, the bomb disposal guy, he's good. He seems to be unflappable, but very quickly we realise there's something. It's not just a bomb that's ticking, there's something ticking in the back of his head too. There's a PTSD issue there. And Superintendent Greenfield, she's brilliant as well, because, you know, how do you evacuate a square mile of, you know, one of London's busiest parts? Like, she's a terrific policewoman, we know that, but she's stretched to her full capacity here. The heist characters, not quite there. As Tara says, Sam Worthington and Theo James, there's the classic honour among thieves and so forth. But they're more to do with the logistics of, they feel more of a trope than the other aspects of the story.
Tara, was there any standout performances for you at all in this movie?
Well, I really like Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and I really liked Aaron Taylor-Johnson.
Because it's a great cast.
He's always good. Everyone in this is good. I think, though, certainly the heist characters they're just not as well written. They're not as well fleshed out. And I think as the film goes on, it becomes much more about the twists and turns and the double crosses. And one of the things that the film does is it plays with chronology. Declan and I are doing this long enough that we remember when Tarantino first exploded onto the screen and everyone wanted to write their own, I'm going to do this, I'm going to play around with time and think. But if you were playing around with time and jumping to an earlier scene, you need to have a reveal that justifies jumping back in time. Mm-hmm. And what you get here is to me not enough of a reveal to justify. And the same with a lot of the double crosses in the film. They just feel like, oh, well, we're going to have a double cross here and we're going to have this betrayal here and this reversal
okay,
here.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And Declan, you would recommend that people leave the cinema for the last 10 minutes because I think there's a coda at the end. What is it? It's
very strange because, I think this is a very slick thriller, and as Tara says, it's full of, you know, crosses and double betrayals and so forth. And if you don't like one, don't worry. There'll be another along in about 3 minutes' time. The coda that happens, and it's about 10 minutes long, feels to me like the producers went to the makers and said, we've watched this, it's terrific, but we don't fully understand the motivations of the bad guys. Can we... And it's just kind of really rough and clumsy compared to the slickness of the previous 90 minutes or so. So when you're sitting in a cinema and you think the film has reached its natural climax, it has. So please do yourself a favour, stand up and leave.
Okay, interesting. Tara, how many stars?
2.
Okay. Declan?
Yeah, I know. I liked this a lot better than that. There's a lot of twists and turns. It feels like a TV series crammed into 90 minutes. 4 stars.
And it's only 90 minutes as well.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't stretched out for 2 hours and 5, you know, which we're finding an awful lot lately with movies. Now to something completely different. This is a film set in rural Macedonia. It's called DJ Amit, and it's the story of Amit, played by Arif Jacob, who is taken out of school to work as a shepherd. This just sounds amazing. Declan, what is this film about?
So, as you say, Ciara, we first meet the Ahmed, who's played by Arif Jacob, and it's we're hearing dance music. He's in a school classroom. He's got his pods in with his classmates. He's having a great time. And then someone comes in and says, you know, Ahmed. And there's actually a little gag. It's Ahmed and 4 of the guys stand up because there's a tiny little school. There's a lot of social conservatism, can we say? And he's pulled out of school. We realise he's been, you know, that's it, 15 years old. That's your education over. You're coming home to mind a sheep, you know, sell the tobacco and so forth. There is an issue at home in that their mother has, his mother and his younger brother Naeem, their mother has died. We're not really told why. The father's struggling to kind of keep the farm going and so forth. So there's strong kind of socioeconomic reasons for this. But because Ahmed is such a kind of outgoing, bluff country lad, who seems to have an interest in, you know, his education at the same time, you can't help but feel disappointed for him as the film opens.
And Tara, the music in this film is so important because it's part of the story. How was it woven through?
Well, it's woven through because very often it's actually in the scenes that you're watching. Like sometimes it's when he wanders, there's a really great sequence where he hears something out at night and you imagine, oh, maybe it's a wild animal or something. And in fact, it's a rave, it's an impromptu rave happening out in the forest, and he wanders into it. And it's an absolutely magical scene, and it's really beautifully shot. I mean, it's a film, there's some really fantastic cinematography all the way through the film. But one of the, I think the best thing for me about the film, and this is where the music kind of comes into it, is that there's a huge culture clash here. It is a very conservative, like Muslim environment, honestly, the conditions that we're like we're looking at very like really extreme poverty, like barely making ends meet, farming, and it's almost like serfdom in a way that you're looking at. I mean, it's proper sort of, they are very much like peasant farmers, who are just like scrubbing together and making ends meet. And then you have this culture clash where they are plugged into music and they are plugged into TikTok. And then that becomes personified by Ahmed's love interest, Aya, who is a girl who is about to be, she's clearly been urbanized. She's more urbanized than him, a lot more kind of with it than him. But, you know, she's there on her phone taking her selfies. And then her family are arranging to marry her off to someone that she's not particularly attracted to. So you have all these kind of clashes going on, and the music very much goes along with that. It's part of the modernity in the film.
And would you agree with that, Declan, in terms of the music?
Absolutely, and it's almost as like the character of Aya almost personifies the music and vice versa, because she has hatched a scheme to get out of this arranged marriage, and how she's going to do it is to kind of dance provocatively at a local village festival and therefore scandalise her husband-to-be and his family and so forth. And this is where the DJ of the DJ Ahmed comes in, because he manages to find these old speakers and strap them on the back of his tractor and find her a way to practice and so forth. It sounds kind of semi-comic, and there is a comic element to this. It's kind of an affectionate comedy about the place. It never makes fun of this kind of conservative background, but it should be Ahmed and Ayed's equally their stories. And, you know, there is a feminist subtext to this, very much so. And yeah, the music, it's a lovely soundtrack, but it plays its part almost like another character, allowing these two characters to find themselves.
And I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but Ahmed isn't allowed to listen to music at home.
This is largely to do with his mother's legacy. His mother was much more of a free spirit, or as much of a free spirit as you might have been in that village. And she always sang to them, to the two brothers. The younger brother, Naeem, has never spoken since his mother died. And this is another issue that his father believes that he has been cursed. So, you know, again, we're talking about a very traditional, old-fashioned kind of culture. And music allows, you know, it is a means of being free. Tara said that scene, that rave scene in the forest in the middle of the night is almost magical, and it is. What makes it even more magical is that Ahmed's flock of sheep goes missing, and he finds the rave by following the sheep, who then invade. So it's just beautifully
incredible.
Comic, but it's also very, very poignant.
Okay, so how many stars, Tara?
Oh, four.
Four. Okay, Declan?
Yeah, great coming of age movie, poignant but also funny. Four stars from
me. I'll absolutely be going to check that out next. That sounds gorgeous. Right, okay. Alfred Hitchcock was the great auteur who made groundbreaking, spine-chilling, magnificent movies, but he relied on the talents of his amazing female leads, including Grace Kelly, Janet Leigh, Tippi Hedren and Kim Novak. And it is now Kim who is centre stage in a new documentary about her great film that she made with Hitchcock, but it's told from her perspective as well as her life before and after the film. Now, mere 92 years old, this is her opportunity to tell her story in Kim Novak's Vertigo, directed by Alexander Felipe. Is it Felipe?
Yeah.
It's Felipe. Tara, who this was originally intended to be a study of the classic, but why did the director decide to expand it into a study of Kim Novak's life and career instead?
So I don't know if you know this filmmaker, but he does these brilliant cinematic essays. And there's, I suppose, broadly speaking, two sort of schools. They fall into two schools. One is sort of a portrait of an older star, like, say, William Shatner. He did a great one with William Shatner 2 years ago, looking back on their career and life. And then the other tends to be more about like cinematic culture. So he did a really good documentary on the called People versus George Lucas, where he talks about fanship and toxic fanship. He did another really good documentary, which was called Lynch Oz, which explored all the links between David Lynch's films and the Wizard of Oz. And so this Kim Novak's Vertigo is doing both things. It is both a portrait of her as a person, as an artist, but it's also exploring the kind of cinematic legacy of Vertigo, because, you know, in Vertigo, the central plot point is that Jimmy Stewart is trying to remake his lost love in Kim Novak's character. And that was very much something that happened to her. She was very much manufactured by Hollywood in the way that they did to starlets in those days. Like they would tell you what you were and what you had to wear. They would tell you you know, what color your hair was going to be, and, you know, what weight you were going to be. So this is all kind of bound up in it. But there's also a huge life there pre-Hollywood, and there's some really horrendous material there. Like she's old enough to have been born in the Depression, and her mother like was so horrified by what was going on around her, and she was close to her mother, by the way. The mother did try to abort her several times because she just didn't want to bring a child into the world with what was going around. And there's an incredible poignancy and sadness about her life. Mm-hmm. But she walked away from Hollywood, became a painter, has rescued animals, had a very long 40-year marriage with her veterinarian husband, and it seems like a very satisfied person. And she also, like, for all the questions and material in the movie, there's still a little bit of mystery around Kim Novak.
Do you know what? We have a clip here where Kim talks about the many roles that she has played.
I mean, the character in Gene Eagles, she would do anything, in a sense, to get ahead. Well, that's not me at all. Not at all.
She was great. So real. And everybody is talking about her performance.
I loved playing that role. She gave me sort of the courage to be perhaps more vocal about my feelings, more expressive.
Jeannie!
Take your hands off of me! I don't want your help. I don't want you to wait for me or to take me home. And I don't want you to worry about me, and I don't want you to love me.
But I learned by playing that role that I could go farther, and that was scary. In Hollywood, you're always playing so many different roles. By the time you've done 10, 12 movies or more, you've got traits of all these others, so that you start to lose who you are.
Declan, how central was she to the success of Vertigo? She stars alongside the great Jimmy Stewart. What's their chemistry like?
So Jimmy Stewart is probably my all-time favourite Hollywood star.
Yeah.
A great actor, but also a great star. Vertigo doesn't work without Kim Novak and the two characters she plays. She plays Madeline and she plays Judy. And she, in this film, she talks about how she doesn't quite say only I could have played Madeline and Judy, but she says she was perfectly cast for it because, you know, that film plays with the idea of split personality and so forth. And later in this film, Kim Novak tells us, and I quote, I was bipolar, although I didn't know that then. And you mentioned, and the film clip talks about the number of roles that she played and that she identified with. And almost every role that she talks about during this film, and it's by no means just about Vertigo, what she either took from or gave to those, the extent to which she identified with, and the amount of psychic energy that must have fully drained her. It's no wonder she left. And I love at least three different times during the film, she insists that she left Hollywood. She wasn't just forgotten or abandoned by Hollywood. She left. So absolutely, when Kim Novak was in a film, it was all about Kim Novak.
Gotcha. And Tara, there's a really powerful moment in the film where she revisits the famous grey suit that she wears in Vertigo, and it was designed by the great Hollywood costume designer Edith Head. Tell us about that.
Well, it's such an amazing suit. And like one of the most appalling things in the film that you learn is that she was called fat by the head of the studio, which is just mind-blowing. Because if you see the suit, it's, you know, you wouldn't get your leg into it. It's such an iconic garment. It's one of the most iconic garments in cinema. And if you remember that bit where she walks out incredibly slowly, and she's very, very like spectral as she walks out, and she's washed out because it's very pale grey, and then she has the platinum blonde hair. So it's an incredibly sort of ghostly sequence. And then when she's remade again, and we get the same effect, and it's just this brilliant doubling up. So it's an incredible like piece of you're aware that you're watching a piece of like great cinematic history, but yeah, the way she talks about it and the way that she like takes it slowly out of the thing, I mean there's a real aura around the suit. Mm-hmm. And that's an incredible moment to behold, but also the way that her relationship with the suit has changed, because she thought it was quite drab the first time she saw it, and she found it quite scratchy and uncomfortable, and now she looks at it and it's like, oh, it's beautiful, and she sees that it's silky, and it's just an incredible mm-hmm. moment. It's like watching someone being reunited with a really great old friend.
Mm-hmm. And you do remember iconic dresses. You know, straight away I think of Kate Winslet's dresses in Titanic, or Keira Knightley's dress in Atonement. You know, yeah. You know, there is kind of certain costumes, I guess, that stand out. Finally, let's just talk about Hitchcock for a minute, Declan, because he seemed to have an unhealthy obsession with blonde women, didn't he? Tippi Hedren, who starred in The Birds, mm-hmm. And is Melanie Griffith's mother and Dakota Johnson's grandmother. He has claimed, you know, that he sexually assaulted her. What does Kim Novak say about that?
I was pleasantly surprised, if I could put it that way, because, yes, Hitchcock does have a reputation not only for an unhealthy obsession with platinum blondes, but also for a very repressive attitude on set and so forth. Kim Novak is very, very flattering about how she worked, and she didn't just work with him on Vertigo, but she's very, very flattering about the way not only that he nurtured her career, she also says very positive things about Jimmy Stewart, but also to the extent to which her own art, because she's a painter, as Tara mentioned, and how her own art kind of either mirrored or developed in parallel with various motifs that he would have developed. So yeah, that's very, and while we're on the subject of her painting, I would say her talking about her own art is actually more important than all the talk about the film in this. I mean, I think it's that integral to who she mm-hmm. truly is.
All right. Okay, stars?
Oh, four.
4?
Oh no, much more for me. An absolute must see, I think. 5 stars.
Amazing. Tara Brady, Declan Burke, thank you so much for going to the cinema for us and for coming into Arena this evening.
Thank you.
This year marks a major milestone for Wexford Festival Opera as it celebrates its 75th anniversary. The season features 3 operas at the Opera House stage, 3 newly commissioned works and an expanded programme from the acclaimed Wexford Factory. The Festival's Development Academy for Emerging Singers, Repetiteurs and Stage Managers. It's also the first season for the festival's new Executive Director, Suzanne Nance. And I'm delighted to welcome Suzanne into Studio One here in RTÉ today, along with Wexford Factory alumni, soprano Maria Matthews and pianist Aoife Mourne. It's really nice to have you here. Maria, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about the Factory at Wexford Festival Opera. It has propelled dozens of artists towards major careers. Tell us about your own journey from the Factory. Where has it taken you?
Yes, so I started in the Factory in 2024. I was a 2024-2025 young artist. And I think for me, the thing that I gained the most from the Factory is confidence and self-belief and the knowledge of how an opera house works and how to work under pressure and how to work with a big workload as well. So sort of vocal management and how to manage your vocal load to make sure you're staying very healthy.
Vanifa, you were also a member of the Factory Programme for Young Artists at Wexford Festival Opera back in 23. What doors did it open for you?
It gave me a lot of opportunities because at that stage I hadn't worked as a repetitor in Ireland yet. So it kind of opened that doorway to working in Ireland, and now I've been working with most opera companies in Ireland, and it gave me that step in, and it also gave me the opportunity, especially to work for me, I worked a lot on Italian opera, and to kind of dive into that world even more with a lot of Italian artists as well. So I really got to the root of what that
meant. Which is amazing, because you're both going to perform for us now. Tell us about the first song. It's an aria from Bellini's opera.
Yes, so this is Qui la voce from Bellini's opera I Puritani. In this aria, Elvira is singing to her love, who she thinks has abandoned her, unfortunately, called Arturo. And she sings about wanting him to come back and her desire for him to be with her.
Was absolutely stunning. That was Bellini's Qui la voce. I want to ask you, Maria, what are some of your favourite roles to play in opera?
I quite like a comedic role. Yeah, I find them quite fun. I've been very, very, very fortunate with my roles in Wexford as a factory artist. Actually, the first role that I got to do there was Nedda in Pagliacci, and it had been on my list of dream roles since I was about 21. So it was the first opera role that I ever learned and performed in full with orchestra. So honestly, it was a dream come true, and what a way to start my factory experience.
Is there one part that you long to play someday that you haven't yet?
I would love to play Norma in Norma by Bellini. Yes, I quite like the Bellini, the music. He writes so well for the voice. The bel canto style is just natural for the singer, especially in the Italian language. Mm. So I'd love to play that.
Aoife, I have to ask you as well. You're talking about repetiteurs. What is the difference between someone who plays the piano and someone who's repetitor?
The main difference is that I'm specialising in working with opera as an opera repetitor, and the repertoire I'm playing is not originally written for piano. It's written for orchestra, and someone's written a reduced version that I can play in rehearsals. So I have to think like an orchestra. I'm thinking, like, when I'm playing my left hand, I'm thinking this needs to sound like a double bass. So how would they play? How would the strings shape this? So I'm in the mind of how an orchestra would play. And I'm also listening to the singers a lot more, because part of the job is also to coach the singers and to help them with various different things, musical aspects, language, whatever I feel needs help. So I have to always have an ear out for them as well when I'm playing.
Aoife, Maria, thank you so much for joining me today. And we'll hear some more music from you guys a little later on. I'm also joined in studio today by the new executive director of Wexford Festival Opera, Suzanne Nance. Congratulations, Suzanne. You took up the role at the beginning of the year. How are you finding it so far?
I am loving it. I'm in love with Wexford and, of course, this incredible festival, Wexford Festival Opera.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about Wexford that is so different to other festivals?
I think it's the DNA of the festival. It was founded in 1951 by a group of friends who loved listening to records. And they started dreaming big and decided to start an arts and music festival. There's a little more that went on to get to that point, but they did. And the entire town wrapped their arms around it, and they've made it happen over 75 years. So the spirit of the festival was born in 1951 against all odds to start an opera festival in Wexford so many years ago. And that continued, that sort of pioneering spirit, that trailblazing spirit, to continue to do new things and bring great art to Ireland and to create it in Ireland.
And you have spent the last 8 years as president and CEO of the Global Media Arts Network, All Classical Radio, based in Portland, Oregon. So how challenging has it been for you, both moving country and job?
Yeah. Well, I'm very lucky that my husband's Irish. He is at University College Dublin, and he's the artistic director of the Choral Scholars. So when I was on the west coast of the United States, I got a call, would you interview this Irish composer who has a new CD out? That's how we met. And I have to say, we went back and forth for 10 years. And
you went back and forth between America and Ireland for 10 years.
Yeah, That's love. But I think it's been very helpful because, you know, moving into this role, Wexford Festival Opera is such an important institution. It's a cultural icon, really, and it's globally known. And I feel a great deal of responsibility to shepherd it and to amplify it to the world. Having, you know, the relationship with my husband and having the insight into the Irish cultural heritage has been profound for me, and it's helped my learning curve. For me, running an arts network, much like what you do here at RTE, it's about providing access. And that's what we're all about at Wexford Festival Opera. So it's been a big change, but the change has been really sort of buoyed by the similarities in what we do and how we love this great art and want to share it with the world.
Now, there's always a theme at Wexford. What is this year's theme?
Yes, the best of. One for the head, one for the heart, and one for the funny bone. And, you know, Rosetta Cookie has woven together this tapestry of opera. There will be more than 70 events this year at the 75th anniversary. And you'll get a little bit of that. You know, what's going to move the heart? What's going to challenge your mind? And then what is going to just make you have an incredible laugh and have a wonderful time?
Recently, Timothy Chalamet, his comments about ballet and opera. How do you feel about that?
Do you know, I actually feel quite sorry for Timothy, to be honest, because number one, I think he's missing out. But number two, I think the fact is what we do is so spectacular. It is storytelling times a thousand, right? It's theater just like amplified. And what we do on the opera stage is it's so special. It's so important. We can't just say it, Kira. We've got to sing it over a full orchestra without a microphone. So I think the magic of the opera is so extraordinary. And I really hope that Timothy can experience that. And actually, he should. We've all been inviting Timothy. Yes, Timothy, come. But more than that, I think his comments actually illuminated our field.
Absolutely.
And I'm very grateful in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. The community opera is a growing element of the Wexford one. Tell me a little bit about that.
The community opera this year is a world premiere by Eilish Nareen, who's creating an opera installation. And the community opera continues to grow and grow, that whole program, which Rosetta has embraced fully. So you'll have, you know, townspeople singing in the opera, and they're fabulous. So the community opera program is really special. It's really important to what we do and who we are at Wexford.
you're new in the position, but I imagine that you've got lots of plans and ideas for the next couple of years at Wexford. Can you share any wish list items that you might be interested in?
For me, it's about setting the stage for the next 75. We've been trailblazers for the past 7+ decades, and now it's time to remind the world. I think what's beautiful for me is coming in and having that big bright light focused on the opera and on Wexford. I think what you can expect is to see how Wexford plays a role in our brand, how important that town is to who we are as an opera festival, and I can't wait to sort of just turn up the light and the sound on Wexford and Wexford Festival Opera.
Oh, look, it sounds like it's going to be an epic 75th season in Wexford, and we wish you luck in your new position as executive director. And now we'll have some more music from Maria and Aoife. Maria, can you introduce your second song for us, please?
Yes, so this is Ch'il bel sogno from Puccini's La Rondine, which translates to A Beautiful Dream.
That was Ch'il bel sogno from Puccini's opera Le Rondine, sung by Maria Matthews and accompanied by repetiteur Aoife Morin. And my thanks to Maria, Aoife, and executive director at Wexford Festival Opera, Suzanne Nance. And priority booking for the 75th anniversary at Wexford opens on April 22nd for Friends of the Festival, and general booking opens on May 6th. Further details at wexfordfestival.com. You're very welcome back to Arena. Now, Welsh author John Doyle won the Writers and Artists Working Class Writers Prize in 2023. His debut novel, Communion, is an Observer Best Debut Novel of 2026. It's set during Easter week in John's hometown of Port Talbot. Communion plays out against the backdrop of a declining steel industry and a strike planned to coincide with a passion play in which the town's locals act out the narrative of Christ's crucifixion. John joins us now. John, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kira. Great to be here.
I know that you had your book launch last night. How did that go? Are you relieved?
I am relieved is the right word. It was a surreal experience. It was something which, you know, you work for so long on something which means so much to you, but it's on your own for so much of the time. So to finally share that with family and friends. And we also held it in at the Plaza Cinema in town. Has been done up into an art centre now. That features in the novel in a different state altogether, but it was like a fitting place to hold it. So it was a special night.
When you just said the Plaza there, obviously I've read the book and I was like, no way, you had the book launched there. Yeah. People that read the book will get it, when you read it. Now, this is such a creative plot for a book, and I just want to talk to you so much about it. We see the story of Communion. We see it unfold through the eyes of Mac O'Brien, and he's a Port Talbot native who has recently returned home. Where has Mac been, and why does he consider his return home a failure?
Yeah, so Mac has spent probably the best part of a decade at a Catholic seminary, and he's fully committed to that way of life. That's how he sees his future panning out. But he leaves before he's ordained under something of a cloud. And it's sort of the reasons why aren't made explicitly clear, at least not straight away. They sort of, as the novel unfurls, it becomes clearer. But he ends up back in town then with his whole identity, I guess, has sort of fallen away from him, and he has to almost start again.
And it's fair to say that Mac isn't exactly sentimental about Port Talbot. Tell me a little bit about how Mac perceives his old hometown.
Yeah, so Port Talbot's a funny place. So steel is so prominent in the town, from the sort of skyline, the image of it, but also the smell on the air, the sound, everything is sort of, we're living under the shadow of the steelworks. So I think, especially once you've been away, to come back to that, it's quite oppressive is probably the wrong word, because you can also grow to love it as well. It's an acquired taste, but it's a special place.
And it's where you grew up.
It is where I grew up, yeah. So it's, yeah. And I think it's one of those places where, you know, everybody knows everyone's tight-knit community. So I think if you stake your life in something like the priesthood, for example, which maybe not everybody would necessarily agree with or think was, you know, the normal thing to do, then it's difficult to go back there and try and fit in with the, you know, the normal workers once again.
Mm, and, you know, you changed path yourself at a similar age to Mac, because you were doing a postgrad in zoology and you decided to give that up. Why was that?
I think I learned that doing research, scientific research, especially with live animals and doing, it wasn't the most sort of violent testing, but it did involve inflicting certain degrees of cruelty on live animals, and it just takes a certain type of person, and I wasn't one of them. I learned that pretty quickly.
Okay.
So when I was still young enough and without any sort of strings attached, I took the jump and went sideways to do writing instead.
And is it true that this is your third attempt at writing a novel?
It is, sadly it is. It's I think if there's any writers listening, you'll understand that it just takes time in the saddle, you know, and also for things to come together beyond your own ability. You know, the stars need to align the right story at the right time, and thankfully Communion happened to do that.
Okay, well, let's go back to the book now, because the Port Talbot locals, and particularly the steel plant workers, they've got a love-hate relationship with the steelworks. Is there an element of, like, Stockholm syndrome at play in Port Talbot?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, but I think it's more than, I think there is a genuine love there as well. You know, it's a cliche, but it is in our blood. So my great-grandfather was a steelworker, my grandfather was a steelworker, my uncle's a steelworker. So, like, I'm the first generation that didn't go into the steelworks, but you do form, your sense of identity is built around the place. But equally, it causes pollution. It does all those things which you can imagine being negative. So I think it's possible to love something and to hate it in some way simultaneously. And I think hopefully that comes out in Communion.
Mm-hmm. And the story, I mean, it's very apt that your book is you know, was launched last night, because the story plays out across Easter week with the town of Port Talbot hosting a town-wide passion play. Are we stretching the metaphor too far if we suggest that it's the town itself that has been crucified?
No, maybe not. So the passion play is an interesting one. So back in 2011, I'm not sure how far this travelled beyond Port Talbot, but the Welsh actor Michael Sheen, who's from the town, sort of cast himself as the Messiah figure in a similar passion play. So he came into the town and the community came out onto the streets and performed this thing. So it's always been something in the back of my mind as just a strange thing that happened to us quite a long time ago. But yeah, but then as the ideas around the steelworks and around, especially like the industrial action and those sort of things sort of came into my head, then, yeah, like you say, the metaphor can be stretched slightly more. And I hope it's not too on the nose, but yeah, that would be fair.
Can we assume, you know, that Michael Sheen is one of the holy trinity of Hollywood actors that we find alluded to in the novel?
Yeah, that's fair.
Because I only found this out today, right, that Richard Burton, Anthony Hopkins and Michael Sheen are all from Port Talbot.
They are indeed. There's something in the water, I think.
But what is it in the water? Because we have Mullingar in Ireland, and that has Niall Horan, Joe Dolan and Brezzy. So Mullingar is our Port Talbot. What is it, I wonder, about the arts? And now yourself, of course,
of course.
Port Talbot has produced some of the greats.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, so I know Michael Sheen has spoken about, like, seeing Richard Burton and Anthony Hopkins go before him and then thinking, oh, well, the path was open to them, so it's open to me too, you know, and seeing that, it felt like a possibility where maybe in other industrial towns it wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there's more to it than that. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe it's something to do with the, I don't know, people say about the Welsh, the voice, you know, and the sort of the sing-song sort of accent. Maybe that just, for whatever reason, grabs the attention. I wasn't blessed with that, I don't think. But Richard Burton definitely was.
I want to talk about the women in the novel as well. I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly. Shuon?
Shuon.
Shuon, I got it right. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, she plays an integral part in this movie because she actually goes to the seminary in which Mac is in, and she confesses something pretty big to him. And he knows this information, and they used to have a physical relationship when they were teenagers, let's say. And then Mac finds himself back in Port Talbot. Tell me about their relationship.
Yeah, so they knew each other in childhood, but it was a strange relationship. So we spoke about the Plaza Cinema. They used to spend long afternoons there with each other watching films. While something was going on with their parents, they sort of felt they were being dumped there for business going on elsewhere, which isn't entirely clear to them. But they sort of drifted apart throughout childhood, and then Siobhan turns up at the seminary with a confession, which isn't an unusual request, because obviously Mark hadn't been ordained, so he shouldn't be taking confessions anyway. But it's also a confession for a sin which he hasn't committed yet. It's a confession in advance, if that makes sense. So when she turns up then in the present, back in Port Talbot, Mark starts to draw a line between the situation with the strike and the works and the passion play and Siobhan's confession, and slowly dawns on him that maybe something quite catastrophic might be taking place, and he's forced to sort of test his loyalties between Siobhan and the seal of silence which comes with a confession versus his loyalties to the town.
And that is, you know, very evident, you know, when you're reading the book as well, because he wants to be a good person, but yet he's helping Siobhan with this very bad thing, is all I'll give away. And he's kind of in and out of it. And he's kind of torn by his like loyalty to her, but also, as you said, his loyalty to the vows, you know, that he was going to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. So in the Gospels, to use the Passion Play as an example, I think the disciples were confused. They were following this radical figure. They didn't know where it was going to end up. There was this promise of salvation at the end of it, but they were like within the actual days it was unfolding, there was just, it was violence, and you know that never leads to a good thing normally.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted Mac to exist in this sort of confused state.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wanted to speak more generally about like the political moment we're in. It feels like radical action is needed. But I don't think we can speak about the radical action needed without acknowledging that maybe the radical action might not always lead to the best consequences, and mistakes could be made, and you know there's a certain sense of sacrifices involved. So I wanted it to be, you know, I didn't want to just write a novel and say, if, you know, a brave person does this thing and saves the day, everything's fine. Like, Mac stands to lose regardless of what he chooses, and he has to sort of walk the line through that.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit why Mac finds John Ruskin's writing on industrial blight so fascinating.
I think Mac's one of those overly serious young men who enjoys who enjoys that sort of thing. And I think maybe that's what drew him to the priesthood in the first place. He's overly idealistic, and he's put in sort of his sort of intellectual side of his morality above anything authentic. But hopefully through the novel, maybe you could see him as misguided through the novel as well, but he's striving, I guess, to find that meaning. Like you say, he wants to live a moral life. He wants to do good, but I'm not entirely sure he's figured out how to do that in an effective way.
This is such a creative debut novel. I mean, you know, when people read it and they hear what, you know, Siobhan confessed to him or whatever, and him coming back to the town, you know, after kind of been semi-kicked out of the seminary, you know. How on earth did you come up with a plot like that?
Yeah, just gradually. You don't come up with it all at once. So like I say, the real-life version of the Passion Play has long been in the back of my mind. And one thing which... In the real life version, it was like in the book where members of the community played all the roles. So workers were playing the apostles. And it struck me, even though they weren't named in that performance, that one of them would have had to have been Judas. So one of the questions which got the novel going for me was, what would a Judas figure look like within a contemporary town like Port Talbot, you know, and what would that mean, and how would they feel? So, yeah, that was one of the questions which it started pushing things in the right direction.
Oh, well, John, look, congratulations. The Communion is absolutely brilliant. I'll be recommending it to my book club. That was author John Doyle. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. And John's debut novel, Communion, is published by Atlantic Books.